Welcome, Capital Raisers. Y'all are in for a treat today as I have the guy who has been in self-storage longer than just about anybody on the show. He's an educator, philanthropist, capital raiser, and fund manager, and he's here with me to break down everything self-storage and drop a ton of knowledge. Yes, I'm talking about Scott Myers. So how y'all doing? Are you ready to raise? If you'd like to explore partnerships with me, talk shop on Capital Raising, or hire me as a coach, use the scheduling link in the show notes. With that, it's Capital Raiser Show, episode 266. And it starts now. Rock and roll, I got Scott Myers on the Capital Raiser Show. Welcome, my friend. How you doing, brother?
I am doing it fantastic, Ruben. Good to catch up with you again.
Yeah, man, this is going to be fun. So actually, just before we got on the podcast, we were talking about Baja California. I was there a few months ago. And you do some cool stuff down there that hopefully we'll chat about here in the show. But for the audience that doesn't know Scott Myers, tell us a little bit about your background. How'd you get into capital raising and self-storage and stuff?
Yeah. So got into real estate investing. Used to work for Lucent Technologies and AT&T and started buying real estate as kind of a hedge for retirement, just because I knew that I couldn't rely on my 401k and their company match, and which is a good thing if you know what happened to that company back in 99 and the tech crunch. So we quickly got into the place where we started to get a sizable amount of single family houses and just realized that we really didn't like the tenant toilet and trash side of the business unless we had somebody else manage it. So economies of scale needed to happen. And so we started buying apartment complexes. And really at that point, Ruben just found that we still really didn't like tenants and we still didn't like toilets and trash. And so all that did is compound. And even though we had property management companies and managers, at the end of the day, the buck still stops with us. And we had to write the checks and still had to meet the police when things went awry, just from people living in your units. We love real estate for all the reasons everybody does. Appreciation, which you can force and create, and depreciation, and you can leverage it and borrow money from individuals in the private equity world and syndication world, as well as from the lenders. And so if we could just get rid of the or not have to deal with the tenants in the toilets, it'd be a great business. Well, that leaves basically parking lots and self-storage. And so I began looking into self-storage because you can't really create a lot of value in parking lots. I like what I saw. We loved what we saw in the industry in terms of if somebody doesn't pay, we get to lock them out by way of the lien laws and sell their stuff off and recoup, you know, most of our back rents and our late fees. And then when they leave, whether it's by way of an auction or just leave on their own, what we're left with is a metal box and a concrete slab. No carpet, no drywall to repair, replace, and paint, no carpet to clean or replace the appliances. And then just the day-to-day wear and tear on us and our staff of having to deal with people living in your units. And so we saw the light, so to speak, and sold everything else off. And that was back in, I've been investing since 93. So this is my 30th year in real estate. And in 2005 is when we found self-storage. And then we sold everything else off and have done nothing since then. So we acquire existing self-storage facilities. Anything and everything that we do is value add. Typically like to find projects where there's an additional acre or two that we can add more buildings and square footage and then income streams to the mix, as well as ancillary income streams and really just our best business practices for turning them around. And then we got into development. So we started developing a number of facilities, and probably our strong suit and our favorite is conversions, you know, buying these old big boxes like Kmart's and other industrial buildings and warehouses and converting them to self-storage. The zoning is in place. We can usually get the shell for much less than what we could build it for. And then we convert it and turn it into storage. And that's been mostly our bread and butter for the past several years. So we're approaching 3 million square feet of self-storage and about 18,000 doors now nationwide. That growth, it doesn't come without, well, we ran out of cash very quickly in around three facilities or so. And then that's when we begin to syndicate and doing private placements, direct investments. We just wrapped up a $25 million fund, getting ready to launch another $50 million fund, and then a number of one-off direct investments that we're doing with a number of our JV partners and family offices and other groups that we've met along the way. We've been doing this since, again, 2005, and we launched in 2007, a consulting company, an education company, and a publishing company all at the same time, assisting people and teaching people how to get into the business and how to develop, how to raise private equity, which is really, again, our strong suit. Yeah, since then, it has just been an incredible journey. We speak for the trade shows and the associations, and I write for Forbes magazine, and it's just been an incredible ride, an incredible journey, and we are just blessed to be a part of this industry, which we love so much and has provided such an incredible life experience for us.
Amazing stuff. Capital Razor Show Season 3 now brought to you by our friends at PitchDecks.com. So shout out to Richard Wilson and his companies. Hey, so I wanted to ask you, there's a lot to unpack there. So how about we start, man, because I want to talk about funds. I want to talk about Forbes. I want to talk. We'll just kind of start with trivial information. So you mentioned that when somebody doesn't make a payment on their self-storage unit, you auction off their stuff. So how does that work? What are the laws? Is there after 60 days you can do it, or after 30 days or as soon as they don't pay? Is that something that you dislike or like about doing it? Do you make any money doing that, or do you just give it away basically to get the stuff out of your storage unit? Tell me about that side of the business.
Kind of all of the above. We definitely like it, put it that way, because back in the habitational real estate days where we had eviction laws, those laws were put in place to protect tenants and against the big bad landlords. And we would go to tenant toilet court and walk out with a little yellow piece of paper or pink piece of paper with a judgment. And the court would state that we get a little bit of money even after they would steal from us, which the courts call non-payment of rent, and then destroy our properties, and which the courts would call excessive wear and tear, unfortunately. And so we'd walk out with a little piece of paper with almost zero ability to collect on that. Whereas in self-storage, they are lien laws, and they're virtually the same across every state. Some states, after 60 days, we can auction off their goods. And in some states, it's 90 days. But the process is very succinct in every state. We have to follow the letter of the law and hit our milestones, meaning we have to send certified letters out. Now we have to state what our process is. For us, we put a lock on their unit called an overlock on the sixth day of the month. If they haven't paid by the sixth of the month, then we overlock them. Or in many of our facilities that are more technologically advanced, we have a software that basically locks or unlocks it based upon the unit that's in, or a lock that's in that unit that is electronic. And so they can't get in. And if they don't pay after a certain number of weeks afterwards, we send a certified letter again. Now we place a lien on their unit and then another certified letter stating, here's the auction date. We're going to auction this off. And we have the right to under this law of this state in order to do so. And so then we usually wait a week or two, and sometimes maybe a month, just depending upon whether we need that unit or not. And also if we have more units, obviously the more people come out for an auction, it's just better for us. And so then the process is just like you may see in the TV shows on Auction Hunters and Storage Wars, very, very similar fashion in all our facilities, where they open up the door, we cut the lock off, open up the door, they get to look inside, they can't go inside and touch anything. And then we sell it off to the highest bidder and they put a lock on. And in many cases, Ruben, we get up to and including or right around the amount that was owed in back rent and late fees. Sometimes it's over, in which case we can't keep that. It goes back to the last known name and address of the person who rented the unit. And in some cases, it's under. We open it up and they may owe us a couple $100 and there's nothing but an old couch and a spare tire in there, all across the board. But I can tell you, first of all, having that in place, accounts receivable as a percentage outstanding beyond 30 days is dramatically lower than when we were operating in the multifamily realm. And there's hardly any money that is outstanding in comparison by way after 90 days, because there's that threat. And then also when we auction it off, we have money actually coming back in. We are the judge and jury, and is not left to the courts in that case.
Fascinating. Are the laws pretty similar all across the country, or does it change state by state?
Nah, they're almost identical. Each state has their own set, but most of them are drafted and adopted by the Self-Storage Association. So they're all virtually the same.
Okay, cool. So you moved into multifamily, I believe it's in 2005. Does that sound right?
I got it into self-storage in 2005. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep.
Okay. So what made you choose that one over like industrial or medical offices or triple net lease or something else?
I think I overlooked it, first of all, for many years, because it wasn't sexy. These are metal boxes on concrete slabs. I like cash flow, and that's exactly what attracted us to it. When we looked at it, it purely is something that is the Cinderella asset class. It was under our nose all the time, but truly I was building a portfolio of multifamily properties. And so I was moving up the ladder in real estate. That sounds a heck of a lot more impressive until we realized that you wake up one day and you got a whole bunch of these, and sometimes that's not fun. And then when I begin to look into the asset class, it has the lowest loan default rate. It has the lowest loan loss rate. The average returns for the REITs and the major players in the industry is far superior to any of the other asset classes. It does extremely well during good times because people buy more stuff and they need to store more stuff. And then during a recession, we actually outperform during the inflationary times because people downsize and businesses downsize and their stuff goes into storage. So the hockey stick effect takes place and we have a reverse trajectory compared to other asset classes in real estate. We're usually second only to liquor. Liquor does the best during a recession and in sectors of our economy. And self-storage is usually right behind it. And so for all those reasons and the lien laws, as I just mentioned, we said it's time to pivot and move in this direction.
Yeah, people are always going to be having life events regardless of what the economy is doing. So people die or downsize or get divorced.
It's all that.
Or
the D's, death, divorce, bankruptcy, all that. We are in the trauma and transition business and we don't celebrate recessions and we don't celebrate pandemics, but they are extremely beneficial to our industry.
Okay, so here's when I've talked to other self-storage syndicators, they talk about how it can be a little bit more challenging to find these deals when you compare the number of multifamily properties that are available versus the number of self-storage units available. You have to specialize the skill of finding these across the country and in specific markets. How was that process for you? How has it been before we get into development? Because that's also something I'm very curious about.
Sure.
But when you're finding deals, like for somebody's out there listening, we have a lot of people that tune into the show because they want to learn about capital raising or learn about different types of syndications. What do they need to know in terms of being able to find and acquire and compete with other self-storage people in the industry?
Fortunately, we are in a position where we've been teaching this business for since longer than anybody out there. And even the folks that are teaching it now, we taught them the business. And so I speak for the trade shows. I write for Forbes magazine and we've had articles, blogs, our events that we've taught. When you Google self-storage, you'll find me and you'll find our organization. And I don't say that from a place of pride or anything else other than we've had all this content and all this exposure out there to our company and our brand for years. And so when people are looking to sell, you know, the folks that are in the business, they either learn from us and they get into it or they've heard me speak somewhere or read our articles or been to our events. We get a first look at a lot of these. So I don't have to expend the marketing dollars. And so that goes for anybody if they're looking to. That is a content race these days. And those that are putting out content are the ones that are going to get eyeballs and attract folks that are looking to sell and attract the brokers and what have you. But outside of that, we still do marketing. We still do direct marketing. We're calling owners by way of databases and our contacts. And we've probably got the largest database and most accurate private database in the country. And so we're constantly calling those markets. And especially, Ruben, once we find a deal or a portfolio or projects that we're working on, then we double down and just descend upon that market and we try to buy everything else around it and develop around it to, again, get that economies of scale for marketing, to driving all of the marketing efforts to one website, one domain, having our district managers located there to spread those management efficiencies across multiple properties in a market. So by way of all those efforts and then just always asking, I mean, everybody in our organization understands. We ask them, what did you sell today? Because everybody's selling something and they're basically selling for the next appointment. They're selling for the next unit. They're selling for the next call with the potential seller of a facility. So we're constantly having our head on a swivel, always looking for opportunities that make sense for us to be able to take down.
Okay. And then you mentioned you like value add. So in addition to adding square footage and adding more units, what are some of the other value add plays in self-storage?
Well, the biggest value add is to buy a piece of dirt and build a building and then put an income stream on it. That's the biggest. So site selection, finding these pockets and holes. And then again, our strong suit, I think we're better than anybody else at finding these abandoned industrial buildings and the old Kmarts, the big boxes, the vacant, the empty buildings that maybe the condo guys and gals and the apartment guys and gals either overlooked or the numbers didn't make sense. They may make sense for self-storage. And then we're converting those and repurposing those into self-storage. And in many cases, adding, they become kind of flex spaces as well, where we're adding some co-working spaces and some retail and other components to them in addition to just self-storage.
Like a mixed
so it's really, I mean, the value add is, we all know what distressed real estate looks like when we find it. And so when we run across it, that includes even the old dusty, worn out, paint stripped, bleached out for sale signs in the middle of a field in a growing market with that land's been sitting there, then we're looking at that as well.
Interesting. Okay. So you also mentioned ancillary streams of income. So what else can you do to add income?
We've identified about 30 different profit centers or income streams that you can add to a self-storage facility. And the most common that people see is that, well, first of all, when you walk into the office, it is more like a retail store. It's like an office that acts as a retail center. And so, yes, we're selling units, but also the insurance that goes along with that, locks, boxes, moving supplies, We do have folks that are using these units in a small business sense as well. So there are Amazon drop shippers or eBay folks that are selling items that they've outgrown their basement, their own garage, or their homes, and for storage. And so they're putting items there in self-storage and running a business out of that as well. For boat and RV services, we have concierge services and detailing that we can add on, propane filling stations. And of course, the most common is to see truck rentals with a U-Haul agency or Budget or any of the other different truck rental companies where essentially we act as an agency and they park their trucks there. We have an agreement with them that we handle the paperwork, the inspections. We have a separate bat phone. It's a line that is directly connected to U-Haul that comes into our site and computer designated just to the U-Haul agency or the truck rental agency. And then we just facilitate that transaction, which is very, very profitable to us as well. Renter's insurance, vending machines, record storage, wine storage. There's a number. Wow. We do these like mini feasibility studies at each site just to see what we can add on and what makes sense to do so.
Fascinating. Okay. And then when you're building, before we go into development, I'm curious about the end product. Let's talk about, do you select, I don't know if you guys have classes like class A, class B, class C or anything like that. Mm-hmm. But I noticed that like some brand new buildings are like climate controlled and others are not. Mm-hmm. So how do you decide that? Is it based off the market or other conditions? Tell me about that part.
It is based off the market. For a number of years, we've been developing a lot of class A facilities, which are just as you mentioned, you know, the multi-story, three-story, the gleaming, shiny facilities that really we're developing those. So eventually we can sell to the REITs, to the bigger players, to the Public Storages or Extra Space or Life Storages and CubeSmarts of the world. But it depends upon, we do a market study, a feasibility study to determine what is the rental rate, first of all, in the market, that is the most important. And then what is the supply index? What is the amount of square footage of self-storage in that market? And when we say a market, we're really looking 3 to 5 miles from a particular site that we've identified, because that's usually all the farther anybody is going to travel to their stuff, to a facility. And then it's just a math equation to reverse engineer back from there. How much does it cost to build it? How much are we paying for the land? And when it's all leased up, how much rent are we going to generate from it? And does that cover our operating expenses, which we've got 18 years of experience in knowing what it's going to take and how much it costs to be able to run and operate these facilities, and then determine our profit after that. And then we take it a step further. And what does that mean to our investors that come alongside of us? And is there enough to be able to offer that return to bring them in?
Now, so I do build to rent subdivision syndications, and it's very different to do that in Phoenix than it is where we invest in the Southeast, because land is cheaper, the zoning laws, the city and the bureaucracy, it moves you a lot faster in those kind of areas versus a big city where there's a lot of red tape and you have to wait and deal with people. Mm-hmm. So how much of that do you take into account when you are building? Are you going into places that are government friendly, or where do you like to build? Tell me about that part.
If we already know that and we already have a presence there, then we're going to double down, meaning it's a little smoother run. But I'll tell you, Ruben, you're probably finding this as well. I'm paying more attention now. The cost, the additional cost or overall cost of a development right now is more a direct function of the time it takes to get this thing up and running than it is the actual cost of the building and the land itself. Mm-hmm. You know, we're finding delays are far more costly than, you know, picking that vendor that is the cheapest. Because if it takes me 18 months to entitle the thing when I'm raising private equity and either paying out a pref on that or tying up my own cash, that's lost opportunity cost. That's money that's been put to bed. That's just sitting there and delay after delay after delay because the zoning is not easy to work with, or they're going to say no eventually, or they've got all these stipulations and they're just slow. I'm going to flesh that out from the beginning. And so that is one of the first calls that we make if we're looking before, either when we're under LOI or once we have an LOI signed. We're going down to the zoning office, and if it's zoning is in place for storage already, I'm still asking the hard questions. And if it's, we're going to get a permit or a variance, then we state, hey, here's this piece of land that we're looking to buy. We're looking to get self-storage, develop self-storage on it. What is the appetite for self-storage in this town? Have self-storage projects been brought to the board to in the past? Was it successful? Why? Why not? I want to be able to remove any and all, or at least identify any roadblocks going into a project. Because if I get a lot of no's and a lot of walls going up and I see that this is going to be a long road, then absolutely we'll walk. It doesn't matter how good the rest of the demographics look, because they're the ones who hold the keys to the kingdom.
Now, do you ever, when you're looking at land, do you ever put an option and say, hey, we're going to go see if we can get the zoning. And then if we do that, then we'll go ahead and complete on the option to purchase your
land.
That
is the That is the only way we'll do it at this point. Okay. I'm not gambling with my money or anybody else's at this point. And in some cases, we'll keep the seller in either by way of paying them, making them sometimes a GP, co-GP, or we'll just delay a sale and let them run it through zoning because they have a better chance of doing it than a new seller coming along. Or a new buyer coming along, new owner.
How's that been working out for you where the owner of the land becomes your partner? Is that beneficial to you? Do you do it only if they don't want to sell the land and that's the way you get them to partner with you, or I should say take down the project?
If it's extremely beneficial to getting it through zoning because they've already done this in the past and they're like a known quantity within the city and it'll cause less friction, we'll give them a very small percentage to stay in because really all they're doing is a task that is worthy of a fee. In essence, however, if they bring that much value to the table, then they may do that, or we may just have a predefined buyout in place when we take them out, either with a refinance or even with the construction financing when it commences. It just depends. We look at every situation to determine how are we going to get this thing across the finish line with the least amount of friction and the shortest amount of time.
I love that. Okay. And then you mentioned that you sell to institutions. I'm not sure if that's all of your projects or some of them. Are you keeping any of these forever? Tell me more about that.
We are. As you know, in raising capital, private equity, you got to have a big bucket of money at some point to get the IRR that you need. You can't always just refinance folks out or that IRR goes down the longer folks stay in. But we do have some projects that are designed that way, some where we refinance and we may hold on to them. By and large, I'd say 80% or more of our projects, we are selling out in 5 years or more to get those returns to our investors and then redeploying that capital. And then there are others that we just own on our own. We're doing with our own funds that we're going to keep long-term as well, or at least for the foreseeable future. So it's a mixture of, we're always looking at cash and how much we have available to make sure that we are never caught short so that we can take advantage of opportunities. And also that it's built into our operating agreements. We're never going to have a capital call. And that's kind of rare and unique in our world, but we can't. So in other words, if we wanted to, or if we ever needed to make a capital call, we can't and we won't because it's built into our operating agreement, which is another reason why many folks want to operate and work with us.
So how about the funds? When did you start doing funds? Did you do a blind pool or some other structure? Tell me about learning about that process and then actually employing that process.
So we've been syndicating for a number of years, Ruben, and doing the one-offs. And that's good because you can cap off a project and you close it out, you move forward together with that group and you sell it. And it's kind of clean. It's maybe a little more stressful if you need to close on a property in a short amount of time and you have to raise the capital in that amount of time. And that is really the reason that we decided to go into a fund. We found that we had more opportunities coming our way than we had capital available. And so if we were continuing to do it with every property that came down the pike and the way we were doing it, we're doing it by way of webinar and phone calls and our investor relations department contacting folks to raise the capital. But if we have another one coming behind it, then some folks would say, well, let's wait until we see what the next one is that Scott has. It may be a better deal. And so we would just get backed up. With a blind pool fund, we raise the capital and we still raise it by way of webinar. You know, we're filling up the fund gradually. And every time we have another project come out, then we let everybody know and get on a webinar and share the deal with them. And then that gets people excited about it. Current investors will invest more in the fund. Other folks coming in for the first time say, wow, I can see the returns that he's getting because we always do an update on the existing facilities that are in the fund. And now we're adding on this one. The brakes and the gas seem to be working very well from that standpoint. But yeah, I wouldn't say kicking and screaming into it, but I never wanted to be in that position where we raise a whole bunch of capital and then I'm paying a pref on it. We're dwindling the amount of cash we have available. And then we're forced, I think, some people are forced to make a bad decision because they just need to put some properties into the fund to cover the cost of the returns that are going out to the investors. So that is really the only reason why we went into it is because we just had a plethora of opportunities that we didn't want to miss out on and we wanted to have that capital available.
Okay, so if somebody comes in with like $200,000 and you just, let's say it's the beginning of the fund and they get into the first deal, how do you make it so that their money goes into the future deal so that it's diversified amongst all the properties?
First of all, they get the returns early. So they have the ability to get those quarterly distributions on the cash flow and the preferred return. So if their money's sitting there idle, better than their money sitting there idle. So they get in on that. They also then take advantage of the depreciation. So each year that they're into it or the earlier they get in, they also get a percentage of the depreciation. And then they also get first crack at the next projects that come along to be able to reinvest again. It's an open fund, but they also get first crack at it. And when we have direct investments, we always reach out to the folks that we have a relationship with And they also get a first look at any of our direct investments if they want to be able to invest in those prior to anybody else. We do have separate classes of shares that we've set up for some of our investors that have that are repeat investors that have come with us on multiple projects. It usually comes with a higher price tag for that separate class of shares as well. But with that, they've already got the confidence, and we have outperformed on all of our projects from day one. And so they know that when we have a project that's coming out, that there's a darn good chance that we're going to exceed our projections based on our past record and track record and history.
And then do you accept money from fund to funds or coach EPs or just big investors? How's that work?
We do all the above. We're working with a number of family offices that we will do co-GPs with. We do fund to funds as well. Many of the relationships that we have right now are the funds and family offices in which they would rather be a co-GP and a direct investment and then share in the LP side and not have a seat at the table, if you will, or at least have a say in some of the decisions. So that's more the direction that we're going right now.
So they invest side by side with you? So they're like part owners and then you're part owners and then you manage.
That is correct.
Okay.
They get equity and they have a say. So essentially the best way to describe it is they can stop a vote or a move going forward if they don't like it. They can't really drive things or really take over and change the direction of what is already said in our operating agreement and our PPM and private placement as to what the fund is and what we plan to do.
So a lot of times family offices can be managed by a Wharton MBA or something like that. Do they give you any problems at all, or is that myth?
Those that have come in have not given us any problems, we'll flesh that out ahead of time. And we really state, hey, here's this is the way it's going to work. And here's the outline, and here's the roles and responsibilities, and here's the input that you can provide. And here's where we draw the line. We are the GPs, and we've been doing this a number of years, and we know what we're doing here. If we happen to go off the rails, there's a way to be able to, anybody, the co-GP and the LPs can vote us out. It doesn't dilute our shares, but if for whatever reason we decide to start making some really bad decisions, they have the ability to vote us out, no different than any other fund. But by the same token, there isn't any of those folks that is coming in that is going to have more experience than we have or know what it's going to take to be able to drive the performance of it. And if they want more than that, then we'll say, well, maybe this isn't the right investment for you. And so we'll put another one in front of you next time out, but it doesn't look like this meets your criteria. So if they want some overarching demands or want to have more of a say in it, you know, then we'll take a step back and decide whether this is something that we want to give up or not. But in most cases, I can tell you that's not going
to
be the case.
That's a very powerful way to capital raise, is to say, hey, we're going to take this down with or without you. And then they're like, the next time they get that fear of missing out, and they're like, oh, okay, well, hold on.
And it's nothing egregious. We're open to assistance and help anywhere along the way. But if these are folks that are on the financial side and they don't have experience in either in real estate or in self-storage where they can lend to the discussion at the table, then they shouldn't really have a discussion at the table. That isn't good for anybody. That's just kind of common sense.
Tell me about writing for Forbes. Is that something I've heard that sometimes you have to pay for that, or maybe you always do? How does that work? It seems like it's an incredible tool for creating authority and confidence in you.
So I used to write for many articles. I've been the voice of the industry for a number of years, and then Forbes created the Forbes Council, and then anybody could write a check and then be able to write for Forbes. And so, yes, it's great exposure. It's great to put as a backdrop and anywhere, the logo anywhere around. But yeah, there's a lot of folks that can pay to be able to be on the Forbes Council and write for them.
I know
you
plenty.
Pay them a certain amount of fee, and then they give you some articles and stuff. I don't know exactly what the program looks like these days, but they stopped asking me to write for them since they created their program to be able to monetize it.
Fascinating. Okay, cool. And then, so what are the typical objections that, I don't know if you target people that are in multifamily that want to diversify, but what kind of stuff do you hear from limited partners when they're changing their mindset from investing in value add multifamily to something else, in your case, self-storage?
Well, they really find us. If yield gets compressed in multifamily and other asset classes, they begin to look around and they'll typically find
they're
us.
They're doing that right now.
Again, we've been out there for a long time. Our funds have, and just our brand, our companies. And so they kind of find us. So they begin to research and they see that self-storage is doing well. And so when they decide to pivot, they usually come over to check us out and see what we're doing. So I've been, again, the voice of the industry for a number of years and just shouting from the rooftops the benefits of self-storage and the reasons why it should be another arrow in your investment quiver, no matter whether you're an active investor or a passive investor. And so now finally folks are recognizing and realizing that this asset class is real, and it is now is no longer the less talked about asset class. It has now come to Main Street, and it is the preferred asset class.
I think so. Yeah. Okay, so tell me about the raising capital. So what are some of your philosophies? Because some people are like, you only need a few investors to talk to if you have really good conversations. And other people are like, hey, you need to get in front of 10,000 people and then just close 10% of them or whatever. What are some of your strategies and philosophies for raising capital?
I think in the beginning, I don't want to say a shotgun approach, but I think you're talking to anybody who will listen, because if you're looking to grow, you'll take on capital as long as they're aligned with you, and at least hopefully. But what we realize along the way is the more investors you have, that is, it takes a little bit more from an investor relations standpoint. Every once in a while, you run across some folks that make your life difficult just because, whatever, unmet expectations, or sometimes there's just difficult individuals. I think it's a natural progression, like in any business. It's just a much easier and simpler and less friction to deal with fewer people that you are aligned with. And so you date. It's like the slow to hire and quick to fire. We build these relationships up with these family offices or different investment groups, and they understand who we are, what we've done. They understand our core values and our morals, and they can see by way of who we are, how we conduct ourselves, and how we have conducted ourselves over multiple years that we do have integrity. And that's, Ruben, you and I have been at Richard Wilson's events many, many years now, and you hear from the panel of experts all the time. They say, well, integrity is what keeps us coming back, but there isn't a family office. They can't see that until they begin to do business with someone. And so that's a tough piece. You can't advertise or just say, hey, I have integrity, come invest with us. They got to be able to see it. And that doesn't come without years of them just following you from the outside and doing their extensive homework and by way of referral or talking with other investment groups that have been working with you. That is, again, our strong suit. And that for multiple years, if we've been doing anything nefarious or not meeting our projections, or if we had any skeletons in our closet, in today's world of social media transparency, I think any syndicator is going to be found out before long, and they won't be able to, to raise capital. I'm not sure if that answers your question
Perfect. But I'm curious about fund administration. So how long, I'm not sure how long you've been doing funds, but have you used the same administrator? What kind of stuff do they do for you? Is it all taxes or do they do other stuff too?
We've had two. We're with one administrator right now, and they're really the back end, and they do have, we have a dedicated person because we've continued to grow. And then we have our own internal relations staff that is working with our folks and pushing communications out and dealing with the intermediaries and their 401ks and the custodians. So we're handling as much of that as possible. We're high touch with our investors and our investment groups. And so we don't, even though we love fund administrators and what they do for us, we'll let them do as much as they can outside of the human touch or the touching our investors, which we handle for the most part inside. So outside of that, we use pitch decks as well. So plug for them, since you mentioned them. They've been very instrumental in doing the background, the pretty side of everything that we do, but also the initial touch points has been very helpful. Andres and the folks that Richard has put together are doing a fantastic job for us.
I love that. Thanks for the plug. Real quick, before we jump into the lightning round, the Academy, it sounds like you launched that a long time ago. What is the benefit? Is it for authority, for teaching people, just out of... for fun, or what is the whole reason behind the Academy?
It started, Ruben, is I used to run the largest real estate investment group here in Indianapolis, about 600 investors. And once they saw that I was investing in self-storage, they wanted to know about it. So we decided, instead of going to for lunch, 600 lunches for people to bend my ear, I started holding workshops. And then some of the agents that hire folks to go speak at different investor groups around the country heard and learned what I was doing. And so put me out on the road. And before I knew it, we kind of launched this whole education business, doing multiple seminars, teaching people how to invest in self-storage, how to develop self-storage, and then how to raise private equity, which is where I spent most of my time. And then our mastermind, it's the first and the oldest self-storage mastermind in the country. Large group of rock stars that are growing and scaling. And so that whole education side of the business is, as I said, it's kind of cool to go to the associations and the trade shows, and the bulk of the folks that are coming through there that have been investing in it since 2007, they've come through our academy, or we've taught them somehow, some way to get into the business. And then that has opened up a lot of doors for us to do our own joint ventures and partnerships and buy some facilities from them by way of wholesale opportunities as well. So I don't spend as much time in the education business as I used to. I'm just really now focusing on our mastermind, which is with the high level folks, the movers and the shakers and the doers in the industry. But the education side is still very robust, and I'm still very much dedicated to sharing my passion and teaching people about this incredible industry.
Amazing. Very cool. All right, man, let's jump into the lightning round. How about we start with this? What's the best vacation you've ever taken?
Costa Rica.
East side or west side?
Yeah, we were in Jaco Beach, the Black Beach. Surfers.
Okay, that's the Pacific.
Yeah. We just got into a groove there every day, getting fresh guacamole for lunch and fresh fruits and vegetables from the market behind us and watching the sunset. from the roof of our condo, and just amazing, just easy to get around, as you know, and real easy for Americans and expats to live there. It was beautiful.
And then if you're single, guys, the Costa Rican girls, they love Americans. Just if, for anybody that's single, I should go check it out. All right, favorite book of any kind?
Well, the Bible is first and foremost. Anything you ever want to know about business and marriage and life in general is found there. Think and Grow Rich. I'm looking at everything that's on my shelf right now is one of those that I continue to keep going back to. And then for the syndication side, The Hands-Off Investor. It's been an incredible book for us to learn how to get better at that side of the business well. And there's a number of them. I'm a voracious reader, and it's hard to pick one.
Yeah, I'm pretty intense about reading this year. I just got like 17 books from Napoleon. And I also got that Brian Burke book. So shout out to him. I'm looking forward to reading that, getting into
that. It's good. Yeah, he's good.
How much of your success has to do with your mindset?
Wow. I think anybody that's an entrepreneur, a successful entrepreneur, by way of you're still in business, I think it is mindset. We're kind of a little bit of a different breed. We're the uber optimists because we get told no a lot. We have to slog through a whole lot before we get to that place where I think, what is it, 80% of all small businesses fail in 5 years. And then after that, another 80% fail or something like that. So I think it is a mindset. You have to have a positive mindset. And going back to Napoleon Hill, 3 feet from gold. And I mean, that kind of sums up where most of us are. We just got to keep going and don't quit because we will hit gold. So I don't know. Is it 90%? Is it a, you could say it's 100%, or you could just say that that's the way I'm wired. It's in my DNA. So I don't know any different. I was never a good employee. There's no way I could go back and work for anybody right now. So I have no choice. So maybe it is 100%.
Very cool. How long do you want to live?
120.
Me too. Actually 121. So we're right on the same page there. Biggest difference between who you are now versus who you were in high school?
Biggest difference. Self-awareness is a beautiful gift that you can give your kids, and it's a beautiful gift that you can give yourself. So back in high school, I was trying to impress everybody else, and now I can really care less. I have an audience of one, and the people that are closest to me know and love me the most. It's all I care about.
I love that. Short answer on this, best way to raise capital from your perspective?
And just relationship. Don't act like you need it. I'm in the self-storage biz. Literally, I'm biased, but the stats don't lie. It's the best game in town. And I'll put our company up against anybody else's. We got the best story in town. And so I think it's just coming from that air of confidence in that we can do what we say we're going to do. And we have done it over and over again. And so if this is right for you, and I'm not a salesperson, I'm not a strong salesperson by any stretch, but logic should drive them to invest with us in the asset class and us. Here's the stats. Either you're in or it's not the right time for you, or it just doesn't fire you up. That's kind of our approach.
Well, I did notice that you're pretty articulate. Do you think part of that is from being a podcast host, or is that something that you always had?
I've been walking this since 2005, and this is all I do. So I guess it's kind of hard to catch me off guard or flat-footed on anything. So I think that does help. You're right. That's a good point, because we teach our folks, we're teaching them how to syndicate, is that if you're in an appointment or in a meeting with some investors or a fund of a fund, and they ask you five questions and one or two of those that you answer is, let me get back to you. That's it. You're out. You're done. You need to know, you need to be prepared, and you need to know your product backwards and forwards. You need to know your company, your returns, your structure, and all of that. It's extremely important that you just know your business inside and out.
What do you love best about self-storage investing?
The lifestyle that is created for it. We got away from the tenants and toilets. And when my kids were young enough, my wife and I got into real estate so that we could travel the world with our kids and go onto the mission field and do whatever we wanted to do. And I don't think that would have happened in the multifamily world or the habitational side of real estate. Yeah, the lifestyle it provides. It is a simple, predictable business model that doesn't have a lot of moving parts with not a whole lot of sense of urgency from an operation standpoint. That being said, we've created a great staff to be able to make that happen. But yeah, just the asset class itself and what it's provided for our family.
All right, what do you love best about ticking off bucket list items with your self-storage mastermind, like diving with sharks and bull riding?
Yeah, so if everybody's wondering, obviously Ruben and I had that conversation before this. Our mastermind, they are the A players. These guys are growing and scaling storage across the country, but they're incredible individuals. And we decided, we're always trying to do some VIP experience every time we get together once a quarter. And so I said, well, I'm going to turn the tables, and instead of it just being me and what I want to do, let's start ticking off some bucket list items. And so we went bull riding, and I was one of the few people that got on this 800 pound bull. Damn. And then we went diving with sharks, and we've done some deep sea fishing, and we're going to Napa. We're doing hot air balloon rides, ride alongs and race cars. And so a lot of it's adrenaline, and other stuff is really cool. But along the way, it's not just those things. It's been able to, when you get a whole bunch of folks in the room that have some resources and connections, we get to have some VIP behind the scenes, backdoor in the cave experiences in Napa. Just it opens doors to places and people that we would never have, just an individual, even including myself, walking down the street. And so those are the types of things that we've been doing, really just taking advantage of the resources that we have within our group to be able to have some really cool experiences with everybody that we just normally wouldn't have.
Now, before you went diving with the sharks, did they tell you what the statistics are of whether or not it's possible to get hurt?
They didn't have to. We all had looked it up. You know, of course, their website is very clear and that these are not dangerous and all that stuff. Man, the second one of these things swims underneath your legs, like 5 feet away, where I could just, you know, dive down and touch it, it scares the living crap out of you.
Wow. That sounds so fun. I got to do that. That's definitely on my bucket list.
Well, I shouldn't say everybody does, but man, what an experience. That was a cool one.
Oh, fantastic. That, and I want to go swimming with whale sharks actually too. Playa
Good
del Carmen,
stuff.
Or I should say Cancun area. Mm-hmm. Isla Mujeres. All right. Do your spiritual philosophies have anything to do with your success in business?
100%. I wouldn't be here if it weren't for my maker who put us here and gives us the opportunities and everything that we have. We're doing our best to be a good steward of what God has given us by way of giving back. We're on the mission field every day with our people, our staff, the people that come through our education business and our investors. And we set aside, at the very beginning, we set aside 10% of all our profits and all our companies to mission work. And now we've settled on building houses down in Mexico, in Ensenada, Mexico. And we've gone on, 15 trips now, house building trips, and we pay for the houses. We pay for everybody to come along with us to have a short-term mission trip and experience. And we realized along the way, Reuben, you can't outgive God. So we have an open hand and we give it back to him. He has blessed our business immensely. So 100% of it, all credit to him.
Yeah, I want to check in with you. That sounds like a lot of fun. Hopefully I can figure out a way to participate. Have you ever experienced a miracle or had a near-death experience?
I had a near-death experience where my friend and I both fell asleep and I was driving the car and we started to go off the road, and by miracle, somebody woke us up as we were going off the road, and it should have been a really nasty experience. Outside of diving with sharks, I can't say that was the closest. And a miracle, not in my own life, but we've experienced some through the power of prayer. Somebody whose body was riddled with cancer 2 days later when they went to visit the doctor was 100% gone. I witnessed it, but not in my, truly in my own life.
Yeah. I always think that like kids and just living in general is a miracle. Like for us to be floating around on this blue bubble in the middle of virtually empty space and experiencing consciousness, I just feel that that's a very miraculous experience.
It is.
Last question brought to you by Shannon Amigo. She'd like to know, what impact would you like to leave in the world?
Wow, I got one left in me, and that is we're going to build another brand and we're going to develop in another part of the world, a number of facilities, and then exit by way of either an IPO or something else. And then at that point, we're going to have a bigger bucket of money. I can spend the rest of my life giving that away until I go home to be with Jesus.
Very cool. Awesome answers on the lightning round. I love that part of the show. Thanks for entertaining us there. Shout out to the Capital Razor Nation. Thanks for tuning in. Please leave us a 5-star written review, and shout out to my company, Legacy Acquisitions, and our sponsors, Good Egg Investment, Syndication Pro, The Family Office Club, and PitchDex.com. Check out their offers at CapitalRazorsShow.com. Mm-hmm. Scott, how does the audience get a hold of you, my friend?
All things self-storage, go to selfstorageinvesting.com. We got a lot of resources for those that are interested in the asset class to invest on the active side. Again, we teach it on the passive side there as well. You get access to our fund and ways that you can invest alongside of us as well. Information on our mastermind for those that are already in self-storage and want to take it to the next level. And then anywhere on the socials, just look up Scott Meyers. That's M-E-Y-E-R-S. We're on LinkedIn, Instagram, YouTube, Facebook, all places and all things self-storage.
Good stuff. And don't forget to check out the Self-Storage podcast.
Yes, sir.
Very cool. Any last words of wisdom for the aspiring capital raiser or self-storage syndicator as they scale in their space?
Man, I'd say right now, there's a whole lot of fear out there. Stop listening to the news. This is going to be the greatest land grab in our lifetime. And it is during a recession or when we're heading into it, where the deals are coming out and will be coming out. And now's the time when everybody else is running out that you should be running in. So turn off the news, get plugged in, learn about whatever asset class that you're looking to invest in real estate, and then go do it.
Thanks, Scott. We covered a lot, man. Thank you so much. That was a blast.
Wow, it's my pleasure, Reuben. Glad we're finally able to get together.
I know. All right, man. I'm sure I'll see you at the Family Office Club events. With that, I'll let you go, man. Enjoy the rest of your day. Thanks again.
Looking forward to it. Thanks, Reuben.